Across London, people are running into the wall Delia is about to describe. Delia is fictional. The wall is not. This is their story. In one of the most deprived constituencies in England, mental health nursing training places sit empty while qualified applicants queue for years to access them. The work that could be done, caring for patients in crisis, supporting families through breakdown, staffing wards that run short every shift, goes undone. Not for lack of people willing to do it, but for lack of institutional willingness to train them.
I grew up in Kennington watching my younger brother Marcus struggle with anxiety attacks that would leave him curled up on the bathroom floor at 3 a.m. unable to breathe properly. Our mum would sit with him for hours, stroking his back, not knowing what else to do. She was a teaching assistant, brilliant with other people's children, but she had no training for this. When Marcus finally got referred to Child and Adolescent Mental Health Services, the waiting list was 8 months. By the time his first appointment came around, he'd learned to hide the worst of it so well that the counsellor discharged him after 3 sessions, saying he seemed to be coping fine. That's when I knew I wanted to be a mental health nurse, not because of some grand calling, but because I'd seen what happened when the help wasn't there. My dad drove the 68 bus from Camberwell to West Norwood every day, and he'd come home with stories about passengers having breakdowns at the back of the bus, people he couldn't help beyond pulling over and calling for an ambulance that might take 2 hours to arrive. I wanted to be the person who knew what to do in those moments. I finished my A-levels at night school while working shifts at a care home in Elephant and Castle, then got my psychology degree from London South Bank University. The plan was clear: mental health nursing training, then onto the wards at South London and Maudsley, where I could actually make a difference. In 2019, I applied to King's College London. Their programme had an excellent reputation, and the campus was a 20-minute walk from where I grew up. When the acceptance letter arrived in May, I called my mum, crying with happiness. 2 weeks before the course was due to start, I received an email that stopped everything cold. "Dear Ms. Thompson, we regret to inform you that your place on the mental health nursing programme has been withdrawn due to reduced Health Education England funding allocations. While you met all academic and personal requirements, we are no longer able to offer you a place for September 2019. I called the admissions office immediately. The woman who answered sounded tired, like she'd been having this conversation all day. "Health Education England told us in July that our funding had been cut," she explained. "We went from 50 places to 30. There was nothing we could do." I asked about waiting lists, deferrals, anything. "You're welcome to reapply next year," she said, "but I can't promise the funding will be restored." I tried Middlesex University the next day. Their mental health nursing coordinator was more direct. "We've had to cut our places from 40 to 25 this year. The Treasury has constrained Health Education England's budget, and they've constrained ours. We simply cannot afford to run the programme at the size we used to." While waiting to reapply, I tried to get work as a healthcare assistant at South London and Maudsley NHS Foundation Trust. The hospital where I'd hoped to work after qualifying was advertising constantly for staff, but when I called their recruitment line, I was told they had a 6-month waiting list for interviews. 6 months for a job they were desperately advertising. It made no sense. I contacted Health Education England directly. The response came from someone called Dr. Sarah Williams in their workforce planning department. "The Treasury has constrained our budget, and we cannot afford to fund additional training places this year. We understand this is disappointing, but government spending on healthcare training must be managed within available resources. There is no funding." That phrase started following me around. Every door I knocked on, every program I inquired about, someone would eventually say it with a kind of resigned authority, as though it explained everything and closed every argument. But walking past King's College London every day on my way to the care home, I started noticing things that didn't fit. The nursing building was still there. The lecture halls marked "Mental Health Nursing" were still there, with their doors locked and lights off. I could see through the windows rows of empty chairs, whiteboards waiting to be used, simulation equipment covered in dust sheets. The building existed. The lecturers existed. I'd seen some of them at conferences I attended. The people who wanted to learn existed. because I was one of them and I'd met dozens of others in the same situation. At a healthcare workers union meeting in Islington, I met Brianna, who told me the same story about general nursing training: cut places, reduced funding, people queuing up while lecture halls sat empty. We started comparing notes. The pattern was everywhere. The government that prints the money was telling us it couldn't find enough money to train the people who were standing right there, ready to learn. In 2021, I finally got a healthcare assistant position. The ward I worked on was chronically understaffed. Qualified mental health nurses were leaving faster than they could be replaced. Job advertisements went up on the hospital notice boards daily: urgent, band 5, mental health nurse needed. I applied again for nursing training in 2022. The response was identical. Ongoing budget constraints meant places were still limited, but I was now working inside the system and I could see the contradiction with my own eyes. We had patients in mental health crisis waiting hours for assessment because there weren't enough qualified nurses. We had healthcare assistants like me doing work that should have been done by people with proper training. And down the road, at King's College London, the nursing school was still running at half capacity because there was no money to fill the places. I used to accept the excuse that there was no money. I hear it differently now. The government that prints the notes and mints the coins told me it could not find enough of them to train the people who were standing right there, ready to work. The real question was never about money. It was about whether the people existed, whether the skills could be taught, whether the lecture halls were available. They were, all of them. The excuse was not a fact. It was a choice wrapped in the language of impossibility. It is the same logic as a household that says we cannot afford it, except a household does not issue its own currency. The government does. The limit was never the money. The limit was the willingness to spend it into the places and the people who needed it. I'm still here, still working as a healthcare assistant, still watching qualified nurses burn out while training places sit unfilled. But I understand now that what happened to me wasn't bad luck or unfortunate timing. It was the predictable result of a system that treats public investment like a household expense, as though the government that issues pounds could run out of pounds. Every constituency has people like me, ready to work, ready to learn, held back not by any real shortage, but by the political choice to keep the resources disconnected from the need.
What Delia experienced has a name: fake experts. This technique relies on citing unnamed authorities to justify inaction. When tobacco companies wanted to delay regulation, they cited "scientists say," without naming which scientists or acknowledging the majority view. The same pattern appears when economists are quoted to justify healthcare underfunding. In Delia's story, Health Education England cited treasury constraints as though these were natural laws rather than political decisions. When challenged on healthcare spending, officials invoke, "Economists say we cannot spend more on health without causing inflation." Which economists? The profession is divided. Many macroeconomists argue the binding constraint is real capacity, not currency. "Economists say," without naming them, is an appeal to unnamed authority. The fake expertise here is the household budget analogy itself, the idea that government spending must be rationed like family finances. This analogy is repeated so often by commentators and officials that it sounds like established fact. But repetition does not make it true. The UK government issues its own currency. It does not need to find pounds before it spends them. The real constraint is resources: people, skills, materials, time. In Delia's constituency, those resources were sitting idle. The nursing students existed. The lecture halls existed. The patients who needed care existed. The resources existed. The people existed. The decision not to connect them was political, not financial. Vauxhall and Camberwell Green ranks 126 out of 543 English constituencies on the deprivation index, placing it in decile 3, among the most deprived areas in England. English indices of deprivation 20 for 25, MHCLG. The constituency has 1,448 registered charities, Charity Commission Register, England and Wales, and received £70.2 million in total grants, 360 giving grant en aide. All sources are published at blockbritain.co.uk. Blocked Britain tells the stories of people whose lives are shaped by the gap between what Britain needs and what its institutions choose to provide. Every character is fictional. Every situation is drawn from official statistics. Produced by Blocked Britain.